Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. During the winter of 1753, George Washington accepted the first and potentially most dangerous mission of his life. He was 21 years old. The resulting tale is one of international intrigue and heartbreaking disappointment that set the stage for the French and Indian War. On this episode, we discuss the early military career of George Washington. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On this series, we're discussing North America's colonial frontier in Season 1, the places and events that defined it, and the people and ideas that changed its history forever. As always, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, from my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. On Season 1, episode of Wartime, we're going to be discussing the early life and military career of George Washington. And we're going to begin there because in many, many ways, it's incredibly revealing about the larger topic that we face as a whole. Yes, we'll be discussing colonial America, but even more than that, we're talking about a much bigger theme in history that transcends all time and all borders. That would be empire. Empire is an incredibly powerful thing, and in the truest sense of the word, empire created the George Washington that we know today. Now, all of us have an opinion on George Washington. We may think of his hardships at Valley Forge, we may focus on his victories at Yorktown, or his first presidential election. For most of us, he just may be the guy on the front of the dollar bill. But no matter how you feel about him, everyone has a reaction, and everyone has an experience with his past. The George Washington we'll be discussing today is nothing like most of us have ever seen. And if you have, it's nothing like any of us have ever truly expected it to be. In the truest sense of the word, George Washington is an empire man. That is, he was a man created by the British Empire. He was a man shaped by its policies, and he was a man who took faith in its ideas. Empire is an amazing event that transcends most borders in human history. And we'll talk a little bit about empire before we can begin discussing George Washington, because as we've said, he is truly the empire man. Now, empire is a lot of things. It takes on a lot of shapes, it takes on a lot of sizes, it takes on a lot of different colors and sometimes even tastes and smells. But that is empire. It's an amazing thing. It's everywhere, and it seems very overwhelming. But herein lies the challenge. We must think of empire as historians would, in a more abstract way. We must change our opinion and open our eyes and see exactly what it looks like, because only then will we get a better sense of it, and only then can we apply it to George Washington's greater life. So if empire is all these things, and it means all these different instances to different people, what's the simplest way for us to deal with it? Empire, at its most reduced level, is really about worldview. It's a game of worldview. It's the reason that I'm speaking to you in English today, and you're generally writing in a Latin script. Both of those things are unrelated, but both of them the result of a larger empire spreading its worldview in a place that it didn't exist before. So when you factor in that basic understanding of imperial strategy, the figure of George Washington becomes much more apparent and much more understandable in the future. So let's talk about the man. Let's talk about his early life, where he's from, what he does, how he becomes the Empire Man. I think it's an amazingly useful exercise, and it's one that we'll use a lot here on Wartime. George Washington is born in 1731, and he's born in what is today the state of Virginia. Now, if you check the records on his birth, it'll often change. Some will say 1731, some will say 1732. And the reason for that, you guessed it, is empire. The decision was made in 1750 in London that the switch should be made from the Julian calendar to the Gregorian calendar. And this would take hold around the world. Anywhere the British had imperial colonies, the year and dating system would change. So suddenly George Washington goes from being born in 1731 to 1732. Again, it's a minor example, but a very revealing example of just how empire can affect the lives of everyday people. So was it really a great change? Well, it did change some things, but it probably didn't change much for the young George Washington. We have differing views and differing opinions on how wealthy he was growing up. But what we can say generally for the most part is that he did have certain privileges and certain rights that the average person wouldn't have had. He was not a member of the wealthiest family in Virginia, but his family did own a plantation with several slaves. So we can say he did sort of skirt the line, if not being above average in his wealth, and therefore his social mobility and prestige. Washington had an easy life early on. I mean, we would assume that by looking at his family's social rank. But as always, there's something more. There's always something underneath the story that's greater. And here's what we can typically say. Washington has his fair share of hardships. He has a vision. He has a plan for growing in this British world. But it doesn't always work out for him the way that he probably wants. So what are we dealing with? Well, at the age of 11, George loses his father. His father dies. And it's a very upsetting moment for him. He doesn't have a close relationship with his mother. She is present. But more importantly for him, he doesn't have a father figure. And in the British world at that time, it's so overwhelmingly important to have someone with you, to guide you, introduce you to the right people, to inject you into their world. And it doesn't take long for George to find that person, because the person who steps up to help him is his older half-brother, Lawrence. And this is one of the most amazing relationships George will ever have in his life. Lawrence is his brother, literally from another mother, but he's at least 10 years older than George. And he's experienced a lot of the splendors that the British world can bring. He is also an Empire Man. And he very well may be the person that makes George the Empire Man. But Lawrence Washington becomes everything to George. He's his father figure. He's his older brother. He's his concierge. He's his mentor. He's his teacher. And when you compare those two lives, you see two very different time frames. And you see how things really are changing in the young George's world. Lawrence was not educated in Virginia. Lawrence wasn't even educated in America. Lawrence was educated in England. And this is a very important step for us. Because when George envisions himself climbing the social ladder, the American Revolution isn't even close. It's a world away. The American presidency and American Republic, it isn't even a twinkle in his eye. Washington is solely focused on climbing the social ladder in the British world. And we have to get that across. That's why I'm saying it so many different times. But Lawrence and George are a study. Lawrence knows his younger brother has to see the British world outside of Virginia, and George is anxious to do it. Now, Lawrence was educated, as we said, in England. He went to the Appleby School, and that was typically the plan for the young George as well. But when his father dies, that's not going to happen. It's never going to go through. The money isn't there, the prestige isn't there, and the opportunity, quite frankly, isn't there for the young George. So Lawrence wants to do everything he can to not only give George a quality education, but give him a sense of the empire. Therefore, George is educated not overseas, but in Virginia, small schools and private tutors all throughout the colony. It's not exactly what his brother had. And if it was, again, an English education, who knows how things would have been different. But George has come to terms with the fact that he is a provincial, but he wants to be British, and he desperately wants to be British. So Lawrence will take him on an expedition that will give him a sense of exactly what he needs to see. In the year 1750, Lawrence is stricken with a terrible bout of tuberculosis, and it was not uncommon at the time. For Lawrence, he'll do everything to try and get rid of this disease. He travels to what is today modern West Virginia. Berkeley Springs is what they'll call it, and there's still a state park there. But he'll soak in the natural springs, hoping for it to heal him in that mineral bath. To this day, if you go there, you can see what they call George Washington's bathtub. Really, it was the younger George just accompanying his brother on the expedition. But what Lawrence really needs is to show George the true splendor of Britain. And there's one place he knows that he can do that, and it's the Caribbean. Lawrence and George will travel to Barbados in 1750 and 1751. And when they get there, their reason is twofold. Yes, Lawrence is going to try to survive this epidemic of tuberculosis. He hopes that the smooth Caribbean winds, the tropical climate, will help him. But he also wants to show George just what exactly the empire can deliver him. And Barbados is an excellent place to do it. Now, if you can't visualize the Caribbean, I'd encourage you to do so. But here's your basic introduction to Barbados. It's the far easternmost island in what we call the Lesser Antilles. So if you're coming from the Atlantic Ocean, it would be one of the first islands you encounter. It's small, and it's sort of shaped like a kidney bean. So it's a very unassuming island, but when you get there, it gives you a full dose of exactly what the empire can provide. Whenever George arrives in Barbados, he describes what he sees as a military occupation. He's only 20 years old at the time. He sees two massive forts protecting both edges of Carlisle Bay. Incidentally, this is still the largest port in Barbados. And he enters the capital city of Bridgetown and is amazed at what he sees. He sees large buildings. He sees elegant churches. He sees very wealthy men and women going about their business. And he also sees something that will change his outlook forever. It's that the wealthiest men and the most prestigious men all have one thing in common. And that one thing is their brilliant red jacket. He sees that Barbados sort of looks like it's under military occupation. And he's right. It's one of the most critical islands in the entire of the British world. And he falls in love with the idea. Whenever he thinks of social mobility in the empire from this moment on, he instantly will think of service. And he becomes enamored, in every sense of the word, with the British military. This was exactly what Lawrence wanted. And it worked. His young, impressionable brother would never be the same. Now, Washington spent a little less than a year in Barbados, and unfortunately his brother Lawrence never got much better. But when he was there, the British Empire worked its charms on him, and he fell for it immediately along the way. Incidentally, he also battled a bout of smallpox when he was in Barbados, and it left his face terribly disfigured. He's scarred from the pox themselves. We often minimize this journey because it seems to be an outlier. But that disease would make Washington sterile, and he would never be able to have his own children for the rest of his life. So it's another glimpse into an amazingly imperial world. But there is no question, there is no doubt, that Washington's life changed forever when he was 20 on his first and last, mind you, mission out of North America. He would never leave the continent again, but he would do everything he possibly could to change it in the future. So where does the Washington story go at this point? Well, it gets a little more difficult from there, but hey, That's why we're here. Lawrence will not lose his tuberculosis. It will stay with him. Washington will return to Virginia with his older half-brother. And within a year, Lawrence is dead. Now, this will be something that occurs through most human lives. Washington loses people that are close to him. But it's the people that die in George's life that I think have a more profound impact than usual. Because he loses his father at the age of 11. He loses his brother now at the age of 20. And it won't be the last father figure that Washington sees disappear in the next 20 years. All of this adds on to George. All of this takes a toll on George. And incidentally, the death of his brother will in many ways be the greatest mechanism for opportunity that he's ever had. Lawrence Washington, before his death, like many men in his social class, has his hands in many different things. He's involved in investment corporations. He's involved in the Virginia militia. And whenever he dies, the imperial structure of the colony has a difficult time dealing with replacing him. They take the position that he held in the militia, and they realize that whoever they put into that position is going to be a political appointment. It really had nothing to do with your ability to lead men on the battlefield. That said, Lawrence did have a fairly extensive naval background. Mount Vernon was named after his British commander in the assault against Spain in Central America. But the imperial leadership needs to make it manageable. You can't just replace a man the stature of Lawrence Washington, and not, at least not easily. So they make the decision to take Washington's original position and break it down into four separate offices. Neither one of these would give any one man the responsibility as a neophyte to control a large amount of soldiers on the battlefield, but it would give four new, younger members of Virginia's gentry class an opportunity for success. Enter the young George Washington. The young George, at the age of 20, understands this, and he begins writing letters to the lieutenant governor of the colony, Robert Dinwiddie. And he says to Dinwiddie, I want to honor my brother. I want to serve my colony. I would like my brother's old commission. Now, Dinwiddie knows Washington, the young George. Most of the power players in Virginia do. He was always around his older half-brother. He was a striking young man. George Washington was 6 feet tall. He had fire red hair. You couldn't miss him if you wanted to. And by all accounts, he was very popular amongst the major distributors of power in the colony. But Dinwiddie wasn't so sure that the young George was in a position yet to be successful. So what we can say is he probably shelved that letter until the opportunity came for George to be perhaps more suited to the position. Now, Dinwiddie's got a lot going on. There's no doubt about that. And this will take us into a much more complicated discussion about the geographic diplomacy of North America in the 1750s. If you can envision North America, picture it from above. It's what we moderns do quite a bit with the continent. You have the East Coast, you have Canada, and you have the Mississippi River. But what you have to deal with is the fact that at this time, the entirety of the continent was largely unknown. And it was shared by not one, not two, not even three, but perhaps four empires. Britain dominated the Atlantic seaboard to the Appalachian Mountains. And the Empire of France had a stranglehold over Canada. The St. Lawrence River was their great lifeline into the heart of the continent. The Spanish had a minimized presence in the south. And in between, in this vast stretch of wilderness, going from the Appalachian Mountains westward, we call this the Ohio Country. And it's where much of the story of colonial America takes place. We often think of colonial America as fiefs and colonial Williamsburg and powdered wigs. And that was all true. But in the reality, when it came to international foreign policy, this enormous, vast, open piece of territory called the Ohio Country was really one of the most important pieces on the chessboard of North America. Now, getting back to empires a bit, there's something we have to come to terms with. Empire is my particular field of study. So I'll drop a few of these lines throughout. They are Brady Kreitzer originals. Empires do their best. They operate at their finest when they compete. And in this way, no matter where you study empires around the world, you see that North America in the 18th century is perhaps one of the greatest imperial clashes in the history of the world. Because it's nothing but competition. It's endless competition. And Washington's life gives us a great view of it as we go forward. But with France and Canada and Britain on the eastern seaboard, they are able to coexist with moderate spurts of conflict for most of the 18th century. But as the French continue to creep southward into the Great Lakes and into the rivers and tributaries of North America, and the English continue to drift further and further west, it's inevitable they're going to come into conflict. And the place that they meet will be that enormous stretch of land we call the Ohio Country. Now, where does Washington fit into this? Well, again, we know the story. It's from his older brother Lawrence, sort of a last legacy before he died. Britain realized it had to have a presence in the Ohio Country. There were multiple reasons for it. There was an enormous amount of natural resources to be harvested. It gave you direct control over the Ohio River, which was a superhighway to the Mississippi and the key to the continent. And, last but not least, if they didn't do it, the Empire of France and Canada would creep southward and do it for them. And that means they lose. So empires and competition are a critical part of this story. Even more critical, perhaps, are the people who live in the Ohio Country. The Ohio Country is vast. The Ohio Country is very different than anything seen in Britain or France. But it also has its own base level of social hierarchy as well. Now, we often minimize this, but what you can consider it is the people that control it and the mechanisms at work are themselves an empire. The dominant power of the Ohio Country, even though Britain and France both hope to be, is a powerful native political force called the Iroquois Confederacy. The Iroquois Confederacy is not one superpower, but it's a collection of six different nations operating together, as confederacies do, when it benefits them most. And as it turns out, that system gave them an entirety of control over the Ohio Country and almost all of what is today the state of New York. The Iroquois Confederacy was made up of six different tribal nations. Moving west to east, they were the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Onondaga, the Oneida, the Tuscarora, and the Mohawk. And it became very clear to both the British and the French that if you're going to control this region, you have got to have the Iroquois Confederacy on your side. It's unavoidable. Think of this. Empire is the science of conquest, but it's the art of collaboration. What do we mean by that? Well, we love saying it, but the British apply a strategy in the Ohio Country, in North America, that they applied everywhere they went in the world. There are two ways to take over a land. You can go in and kill everyone. Not terribly effective, but it has been done before. Okay, look at the Empire of Spain in Central and South America. Or you can find someone who's already in power, form a alliance, a political bond with them, and use their existing channels of power to insert your own. For the British, this was the Iroquois Confederacy. And in the earlier part of the 18th century, the 1700s, they created what they called the Covenant Chain. And this was an official alliance between the Empire of Great Britain and the Iroquois Confederacy. And this tends to hold all the way until we get to 1753. Because in 1753, the two worlds of France and Britain, New France and North America, and the British colonies of the Eastern Seaboard finally begin to collide. And the place they do is the Ohio Country. It's an amazingly powerful and profound idea. But these two empires, controlled and separated by an ocean, begin to come together and conflict in a place as far and distant and as away from their world as possible, the wilderness of North America. That's the power of empire. And we have to keep that in mind as we talk about it, because it will be a guiding light throughout the rest of this series. Now, where does the immediate conflict come from? In 1753, the French will look at the Ohio Country as open territory, as fair game. Now, both sides have a claim to it. About 5 years earlier, the Empire of France sent an expedition under the control of a man named Céloron de Blainville. And he went through the Ohio Country, dropping lead plates, marking everywhere he went, claiming the land and the waters for France. In their opinions, it was theirs. For the British, they had their own claim, equally legitimate, but maybe equally illegitimate. It was the end of one of a major war between Britain and France that produced a document called the Treaty of Utrecht. And in the Treaty of Utrecht, it said that the Iroquois Confederacy, in a minor footnote, were British citizens, and therefore the land they lived on was Britain. Well, that was the Ohio Country. So therein lies the problem. When the French begin to advance into the Ohio Country, this endless stretch of wilderness, the British view it as an act of war. And when the British retaliate, the French will as well. In the spring of 1753, coming out of Lake Erie, after going through the Niagara River, Lake Ontario, and of course, the French lifeline of the St. Lawrence, the French begin fortifying the Ohio Country. They build two forts with all of the visible plans to build more deeper into the region. Now, the Ohio Country today is all of western Pennsylvania and all of the state of Ohio. And the area where they were primarily focusing was immediately south of Lake Erie toward what is today the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And it's all completed that journey through waterways. We'll talk about that in a future episode. But that's what we see. The French will build a fort they call Fort Presque Isle on Lake Erie. And about 15 miles south of that, they'll build a fort they call Fort Lebeuf. And as it occurs, the season gets late, 1753 begins to wind down. And it's clear that whatever they're going to build is not going to be completed until the following spring. So it now falls on the British to react. If the Ohio Country is their land, and the French have begun to fortify on it, that's clearly a violation of international treaty and likely an act of war. Parliament will send a letter to the colony of Virginia. And when they do so, they allow them to use force if necessary to eliminate the French from the region. And this gets us back to our old friend, the young man, the 21-year-old George Washington. The lieutenant governor of Virginia is the one who will make this decision, and his name is Robert Dinwiddie. Remember, Washington sent him a letter upon the death of his older half-brother, Lawrence. Dinwiddie knows he has a lot to lose if the French do occupy the Ohio Country. Why does he have a lot to lose? Well, aside from the fact that he's a political official, money and politics always will go hand in hand. Dinwiddie and the late Lawrence Washington were both part of an investment group called the Ohio Company of Virginia, and they put their own money and their own resources together to speculate land in the Ohio Country. They wanted to buy it and sell it at a profit, right? They were very much the Donald Trumps of their days. So he has multiple stakes here. The Empire stands to lose if the French succeed. Dinwiddie stands to lose a lot of money if the French succeed. And what he has to do is put together a mission in some way, shape, or form to march northward on what will be a hellish journey to Fort Lebeuf, again about 15 miles south of Lake Erie, and politely ask the French to leave. So who will do this? Who could undertake such a mission? Well, it wasn't a terribly dangerous mission, not by any stretch of the imagination, but it was an important one. It's a good introductory expedition for someone who's anxious to succeed, but not someone who's already been successful enough that the mission would be beneath them. The lieutenant governor says, "This mission is for a glorified mail carrier." Well, then he sees the letter from the young George. He calls the young George Washington, now 21 years old, to Williamsburg, and he tells him, "Your time has come. I'm going to make you a major in the Virginia militia, and I'm going to give you your very first mission." Now, most people who are experienced would have looked at this as a nightmare, marching through the wilderness in the dead of winter to deliver a letter, essentially. But the young Washington is thrilled by the idea of it, because it's everything he's wanted to be, and he gets a commission. He has a title. What could go wrong? Little does he know that George Washington will die almost twice on this mission, a mission that is supposed to be easy, but it will change his life forever. By November of 1753, the young Washington finds himself at the confluence of not one, not two, but three rivers in the heart of western Pennsylvania. The Monongahela is flowing northward, the Allegheny River is flowing southward, and they come together to form the mighty Ohio River, and they form a triangular piece of land he calls, known in the time period, as the Forks of the Ohio. Washington will stand on this position and say he believes it's a fantastic place for a fortification. He writes it in a very detailed journal. Today, this is the modern site of the city of Pittsburgh, and that triangular piece of land is still well preserved. It's known as Point State Park. But at any rate, Washington will not be alone on this mission. He has about a dozen men with him. They are agents of the Ohio Company of Virginia, that investment group that Lawrence Washington and Robert Dinwiddie were both a part of. And they really have the basic idea, the basic mission to keep this young man alive. You have experience in this alien, foreign, tribal world. The young Washington doesn't. It'll be led by Christopher Gist, who is very much one of the great roughnecks of his day. He lives in this difficult world. He understands it. He assembles a team with him to do that. Washington and his men will march, and their first stop will be a small, primitive, but bustling Indian village along the Ohio River known as Logstown. Now, Logstown gives us a great glimpse into this larger world. The French built it almost 30 years earlier. And the reason the French built it was because they wanted to build good relations with the native peoples who lived there. If you're going to be in the region, whether you're British, French, or Indian, you have to go to Logstown. And that's exactly what Washington and his men do. When they're there, they meet the highest ranking Indian diplomat in the region. His title is Half King. His name is Tanacharison. Some call him Tanagrison. There's dispute. Either one is entirely acceptable. Tanacharison, the Half King, will meet with Washington, and he will promise to march with him in solidarity, to show that the Iroquois Confederacy and the British Empire are unified against this new French threat. But it's never that easy. Washington, even though he's wearing the red coat, is a nobody in the greater scheme of British imperial policy. And Tanacharison, the half-king, the highest-ranking Iroquois diplomat in the region, is a man who's losing power every day, rather than asserting it in a dominant fashion every day. The basic of French policy is this. They know if they're going to war with Britain, they need an Indian ally. But they also know that the Iroquois and the British are fairly well entrenched together. So who could be their Indian ally? Well, the French have a complete lockdown on the Great Lakes region with the Miami, the Potawatomi, the Ottawa peoples. But they also know that the Iroquois Confederacy, like all empires, has its own group of subjects. They are the Shawnee, they are the Delaware, they are the Mingo. They live in the Ohio country. These people do not like the Iroquois. The Iroquois oppress them, but they are Iroquois subjects. So from the French vantage point, if you can win the subjects of the Iroquois Confederacy to your side, you have yourself an Indian ally. The Ohioans, is what we collectively call those subjects, will rally with the French, ultimately. And Logstown was built as a way of wooing them to their side. So Tanacharison, the half-king, knows there is a resistance movement, a separatist movement emerging in the Ohio country of Ohioan Indians now given a mechanism to throw off Iroquois control. That mechanism is New France, and that resistance will manifest itself in the upcoming French and Indian War. Washington will march with the half-king, both of them inflated in who they are. Washington believes he's much more important than he is. The half-king believes he's much more powerful than he used to be. And of course, neither one is true. But they ultimately make their way to Fort Lebeuf. And when they get there, Washington, over the last several weeks, marching through the snow, marching through the terrible conditions of winter in western Pennsylvania, has been building up this moment as the key critical juncture between two massive empires. In reality, it was a weak and almost meaningless diplomatic mission. Washington will deliver his letter to the commandant of Fort Lebeuf. The commandant will write a letter back to Robert Dinwiddie and send him on his way. The letter that Washington delivered, he never read, basically told the French, get out or else. The letter that the French responded with basically said the same thing. We're here to stay. If you want us to leave, you can make us leave. The original language was, I do not feel obliged to observe your request, sir. It's all very dignified. But Washington will be sent on his way, and his great expedition, which incidentally has only ever been written in one book, which was my first book, Major Washington's Pittsburgh and the Mission to Fort Lebeuf, will be overall a failure. But the hardships for Washington have just begun. For on the way back south, he has to break his group into two component parts. There are far too many supplies to be moved, and to do so would be very slow. So Washington's larger party of men go forward. Washington and Gist, 21 years old, will follow about 3 days behind. As they're moving south, they'll follow the Allegheny River southward. And as they do that, they'll encounter what is probably the most important Indian village of the region. It's called Venango. And when they're there, they'll stay the night. But as they're waiting, Washington is not very observant. It's an amazingly hilarious consequence. But Washington keeps a journal of his experiences. He writes about all of the great encounters he has. He makes them all seem very important. Well, Christopher Gist, his guide, also keeps a journal. And you kind of see the reality, sort of the rose-colored glasses come off when you compare those two journals together. But Washington and Gist will continue to move south until they get to a smaller Indian village called Murdering Town. And when they're there, an Ohioan Indian will approach them and tell them, I'd like to help you get to your destination faster. Now, Washington, of course, is all for this. Oh, get to our destination faster. That's something we'd love to do. But Gist is always weary of it because he believes he's seen this Indian guide before, dealing with the French in the Indian village of Venango. Washington obliges the native guide. He says, follow me. I'll get you to your destination. And very quickly, after a long bit of walking, several miles, Gist realizes this Indian guide is taking them in a completely wrong direction. By the time Washington figures it out, the Indian guide runs ahead about 10 to 15 yards, drops down to one knee, and fires on the young major. Wherever the bullet went, it missed Washington, but it couldn't have missed him by much. And here we have, for the first time, the 21-year-old George Washington nearly loses his life. How different would the world have been if that bullet found its mark? Washington survived, the guide escapes. Clearly the game is afoot between these two large empires. And Washington and his guide, Gist, will continue to move southward. By the time they get to the Allegheny River, again, the forks of the Ohio, they found that the deep winter cold has not yet frozen the river over. Their plan was to walk, but they can't. So they have to build a raft. Now, in their infinite wisdom, they gave away most of their supplies to Gist and his team that went ahead of them. They had one hatchet between them. They will spend the whole of the day chopping down trees, taking turns, with this one hatchet, until they finally can fashion a raft. By the time they do, the sun is already going down. They climb on this raft, they try to cross the Allegheny River, icy at this point. And because of his somewhat sheltered upbringing, Washington clearly has never forded a river with a raft. He actually falls off into the water. Christopher Gift pulls him to safety. They drift to a nearby island, and Washington, covered in his clothes and Gist's clothes and several fires, is watched very closely because it's very likely he would not have survived the night otherwise. Hypothermia was setting in. As it turns out, the watchful Christopher Gist, after pulling the man from the water, was able to revive him. Washington was able to walk on his own power the next day. And incidentally, that river froze over. But that's the second time in 3 days that George Washington, largely out of his own incompetence, could have been killed, and probably should have been killed. It's an amazing story, but it teaches him a great deal about life and responsibility and service to his empire. There's no question. And even though the mission overall is a failure, like all of us, when he returns to report his meager findings, he gets a promotion. So it's good to be George Washington at that time. And this is, again, not a trivial story. I think it's a very revealing story about the complexity of British North America and the way that people who live there view it. Again, revolution is 20 years off, and that's a powerful force. We'll discuss it. But at this point, it's nowhere close. People are so enamored with defending their own British way of life against a potential French intrusion that revolution is light years away. It's important we remember, though, the seeds of the American Revolution are planted in the ends of this 7 years war or French and Indian War that's about to emerge. But as far as the young George Washington's is concerned, his future is now set in stone. He's in the military. He will be in the military. And in 30 years, he'll be considered one of the single greatest military leaders in the history of the world. Thank you for joining me. We'll see you next time. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.